John is going to tell us the format of the evening. I just wanted to welcome you all and welcome also Jackie Baldwin, who's here. Ian Robinson, who was Ian Patrick, you'll see on some of his other books, but if you've listened to the podcast, you'll know why that's changed. Anne Blockwich and John Dean are here to take us on a walk on the dark side. Enjoy, everybody.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'll get the authors to introduce themselves in a minute. I'll just tell you a little bit about the format. One thing I would say, we've got a big audience. I'm conscious that those at the back can't see us. Two things, we have got microphones so you can hear us. And the other thing is, we are astonishingly beautiful. But hopefully you'll enjoy the evening. The evening's split into two halves, because that's the way halves work. And we'll take an interval after about 45 minutes. The two halves are different themes. The first half is the theme of openings, and we'll look at how our people became writers and how they begin their stories. And in the second half, we'll look at murderous intentions. We'll look at why we kill for a living. And at the end of each half, we'll hand over for about 5-10 minutes for Q&A, so you can question us on each theme, because I think all of our experience of nights like this are you always come with loads of questions. So we'll do that, and we'll aim to finish and chuck you out at about 9:30. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for supporting Kukubri Book Week. I'll hand over to the people to tell them who they are.
My name's Jackie Baldwin, and I'm from Dumfries. Most of my life I've lived in Dumfries with a 12-year detour to Moffat. However, I now live up in East Lothian. I was a former solicitor, practising in family and criminal law in Dumfries for many years. And then I retrained as a hypnotherapist and wrote a crime novel. So a bit of a midlife crisis there, obviously. So I'll pass you to someone else.
As mentioned, I'm John Dean. I'm the creator of Jack Harris and John Blizzard, former crime reporter, former journalist, and now full-time writer. Anne, you're on.
Thank you. So I'm Anne Blockswich, and I'm a short tattooed woman with a love of murder, cats, and rock music. Sums me up in one. And my first book, What Goes Around, is set in the Midlands, because that's where I lived at the time. And so I moved to Dumfries so that no one tries to get me back for what I've done to them in the book.
Thank you. My name is Ian Patrick Robinson. Ian Robinson. So I've written under Ian Patrick, and I've got current books out with the Book Folk of London. A former Met Police DS for 27 years. And later in my career, I found out that I had a muscular dystrophy. So I turned to writing as I realized I was going to be sat on my butt for rather a long time and thought it would be a good thing to do. And I was pretty lucky in the fact that I've managed to achieve that. So that is me. And I'll hand you back to John.
Right, so what we're going to do is try and make this as natural a conversation as possible for half an hour whilst passing the microphones desperately in between us. The first question I was going to ask our authors was, when did you want to be... Yeah, you've got the second one there. When did you know you wanted to be a writer? And from my point of view, from the moment I could create stories, I wanted to be a writer. From the age of 4 or 5, inspired by a primary school teacher who believed in creativity, I wanted to be a writer. And throughout my life, with all the setbacks that writers get, that's kept me going, really, the desire to tell stories and the desire to entertain people. So, Jackie, what made you write?
Very similar, John. I remember when I was 7, I had a teacher of a similar ilk, and she had me making a play and doing all these dramatic stories, and I just loved it. And so she really instilled that love of stories into me and made me believe that I could write them. So very, very similar story.
Does that microphone work?
Yes, it does. She'll kill you for that. Her husband's a sound man. Don't ever blow into a microphone. So,
make a good book.
Well, yeah. Oh, I've already pinched that one, don't worry. So... I had a wonderful English teacher at secondary school. I was the only person in my year that was encouraged to go for O-level English. But I put the writing away for a long time because I've got my eldest son's disabled. He has cerebral palsy and Asperger's, so spend a lot of time at home looking after him. And because he does have violent tendencies, some days it got very fraught, so I thought, I'm not allowed to beat him to senseless, so I'll write it down. And I thought, I could actually turn that into a book. And then I was also a promoter at the time for a bunch of male strippers, which... the easiest way to sum them up is 6-foot toddlers. But I did. One of them did say to me, they were telling some wild story, and I said, I should write a book about you guys. And he went, that would probably work really well. So I thought, this is an idea. And then went to a book festival and got the idea from there. So, and you're not allowed to kill people in real life. So, but you can on paper, and it's very satisfying.
Thank you. So my writing started at Hay Festival. 20 years ago. It was on honeymoon before we went to Venice, and there was the artist tent, and we were wandering around, and we happened to just wander into the artist tent. I just could see pictures up on the inside of the walls on the canvas, and we got handed champagne. I thought, oh God, this is quite nice. And Margaret Atwood was sat on a sofa, and she looked up and she nodded at me and she said, hello. I said, hi. And Jermaine Greer was there. I said, hi. And the hostess came up. She said, so when are you on? I said, sorry. And she said, what event? I had the champagne flute and everything. I said, I just came in to look at the pictures. And she said to me, oh, because it's like, you know, this is the artist tent. And I was like, I do now. Here's your champagne. I'm very sorry. I'll go out. I said, you know what? You could have easily carried that off. And at that point, I thought, you know what? I'm gonna give this a go. So that is actually how it started. So I could do this. And so far so good.
I mean, the next question, I'll stick with you for the moment, Ian. Why crime? I mean, I know why you do crime, but what drove you to crime? What's the attraction?
Well, there is a bit of an urban myth that after 30 years in the police, I'd be very good at writing fiction. But for the purpose of the podcast, that is a absolute lie. So the first book I wrote was a book called Artificial, which is kind of play on the commitments. And I gave that to an author friend, Anne Coates actually it was, to read it and to give me some feedback. And she was, let's say, brutally honest. So that was 90,000 words shelved. And I thought, you know what, they say write what you know. And so I thought, well, I'll have a go at crime. And there was a publishing house called No Exit Press that had a competition for a short story. So I thought, well, I'll just do that. Because they're local, I thought, and I was local in Harpenden at the time, they'll just take me on. That was how naive I was. Anyway, I did this short story, that was the beginning of Rubicon, my debut, and I got longlisted, and I got down to the final three. And so from there, I just thought, you know, I'm gonna carry on. And it was, that was it.
What about you, Anne? What drove you to crime?
Well, like I said, I used to look after a bunch of male strippers. I think I've always read crime novels, and I picked up my first Dick Francis book, which I forget the title of it, but it was set on a train, and it was so fast and pacing, and I was like, this is brilliant. And then obviously later on, with the problems with my son and things, I thought, well, yeah, there could be a story there, because a lot of we're all sick of reading of the detective with the drink problem, and the one who's sleeping with his WPC or whoever. And I thought, I want my detective to be a nice guy, but he's got family problems. So I thought, I've never seen anyone with the same dynamics as me, so I thought, I'm going to start there. And then I did put the guys in the book, because there were a few that weren't so pleasant. So it was a nice, cathartic way of dealing with that, by getting them into hot water on paper.
I think for me, as a journalist, I always refer to, there was a newspaper in New York a number of years ago, and the editor said, we will only ever publish good, happy news. And within a fortnight, they'd gone bust. And the truth is that people like to read bad news. And good people like yourselves, you're wonderful. You're the salt of the earth. But bad people, they're just a touch more interesting. And that's what interested me. What is it that drives people to commit acts of evil? And that's why I wanted to write about crime and murder or whatever. I'm fascinated by motives. I'm fascinated by what would drive a perfectly rational, law-abiding person to do abominable things, really. And so that's what I concentrate on, really, and that's why I write crime. What about you?
I think for me it was a bit of write what you know, because at the time I had a really demanding job and two young kids. And so I got the opportunity that we used to have writers in residence here. I don't know if many of you remember those happy days. But anyway, you could apply for a mentoring scheme to write a longer work. And up until then, I'd only really written a few monologues and things like that. So I thought, oh, this is my chance to try and write a book. Because I thought, well, you know, I might let myself down by not doing it, but I thought if someone else has invested their time in me, I'm not going to let them down. So I thought that really would make all the difference. So as to why crime specifically, for me, I was working as a lawyer doing criminal work, so I was fairly familiar with the courts, wandering around the police station and cells, all that kind of stuff. So and plus there was always the advice, right, John had said, what you know. So I thought, well, what do I know that won't require an awful lot of research? Because I was really time starved at the time. So I thought, right, you know, crime and Catholics, that's got to be it. Because I'd gone to the convent in Dumfries, you know, the school there. So that's how it, and also I liked the fact it was a bit like a security blanket crime, because it gave you like a coat hanger or a scaffold for your story. Because I was a bit daunted by the prospect of just launching into a book, not knowing where I was going or what was going to happen. So I quite like the idea that it gave you that scaffolding on which to hang a story. So I think for me, it was all these factors.
Do you want to read an extract as well?
Sure. Can everyone hear me from that? So I'm going to read to you the prologue from Perfect Dead. And the reason I chose this book is because it's set in Kirkcupery. And also, in fact, there's a scene later in the book that's set in the very place we're in just now, Broughton House. So I'm not reading you that part because it was a wee bit too long. So this is just the prologue. June 2009. Eilish opened her eyes and closed them again as her head started to throb. She stumbled to her feet, fighting the urge to throw up. Unwelcome flashbacks of the night before painted her face in disgust. Looking at her slight form in the mirror with yesterday's makeup blurring the lines of her face, she felt older than her 19 years. She glanced at her phone and tears prickled. It was her mother's birthday. She could picture her sister and father laughing and chatting as she opened her presents in Ireland. It was as if she had ceased to exist, such was the disgrace she had rained down on them when she'd ran off with Patrick 3 years ago. He'd completely turned her head with all his big talk. She'd fancied they would live in London, not the tiny harbour town of Kirkcupery, tucked away in a corner of southwest Scotland. Instead of the romantic existence she'd pictured for them, they'd wound up living in this glorified hippie commune, or the collective, as they like to be known. At first it had been fun, exciting even, a world away from the parochial, narrow-minded community she'd left behind. She'd been proud to be Paddy's muse and loved nothing more than to bask in the warmth of his regard as he painted her from various angles. lately she'd felt Patrick's love receding like an outgoing tide. He was preoccupied and distant and hadn't asked her to pose for him in ages. The atmosphere in the house was different as well. She had a feeling they were all keeping secrets from her and each other. They'd always used drugs, but lately the drugs had become harder. The parties more forced and a little weirder. There was a powerful undertow dragging them all down to God knows where. Suddenly, as she looked out of the window, she knew with unusual clarity that she didn't want to be part of this toxic environment anymore. She'd lay it on the line with Patrick and ask him to leave with her. After a quick shower, she threw on her favourite dress and swept up her long curly hair just as he liked it. She flung open the door to the studio and stood open-mouthed, tears spilling from her eyes as she took in the scene before her. A beautiful young girl stared back at her insolently, maintaining her pose. She was reclining naked on a velvet chaise longue, one arm positioned behind her head. Only the blush of colour staining her chest betrayed her. Patrick turned round and their eyes met. He dropped his gaze. There was nothing left to say. Eilish spun on her heel and left the studio. It was time to go home and beg for forgiveness. She texted her elder sister Maureen, "I'm sorry, please forgive me. I'm on my way home, Eilish." Walking towards the bus stop, she heard her name being called. Surprised, she glanced behind her. When she saw who it was, she smiled and walked towards him. The bus wasn't due for another hour. She had time. Soon she was ensconced in a comfy armchair, knees drawn up under her, a warm mug of hot chocolate clasped in her hands. As she poured out her woes, he leaned forward attentively. The drink was comforting, strong and sweet. She didn't feel so good. Her eyes couldn't focus. She struggled to stand up, but her legs wouldn't support her and she collapsed back onto the chair. Alarmed now, her heart flopped in an irregular rhythm as she tried to make sense of what was happening to her. "Help me," she whispered, looking up at him. This couldn't be happening. She didn't understand. He remained where he was, a creeping malevolence revealing itself to her. She was on the verge of losing consciousness when he picked up her unresisting body and carried her into another room. He laid her on a thick plastic sheet. A last tear tipped from her eyes. She would never see her home again.
Right, for the last 10 minutes or so before we end our chat and turn it over to yourselves, and Ian will read a little bit before that, we wanted to look at the idea of openings. All writers wander around with a big box in their head, and on the side of it says ideas for the next novel. And for a lot of the time, it's empty. And you give it a rattle and nothing comes out, and you get a bit desperate. And then there's a moment, something clicks, something flicks a trigger, a switch or whatever, and you see something, you hear something, and suddenly that box is full of ideas and fragments and emotions and all sorts of stuff, and you're away, and you'll spend the next 10 months developing the ideas. So what I was going to ask the writers is, what are your triggers, Ian? What is it that makes you go from a writer without a clue of what you're going to do to a writer with a novel in their mind?
I don't know.
Thank you for coming, ladies and gentlemen.
I must admit, I mean, I've written 9 books, and some days I still don't have a clue what I'm doing. You know, when I start a book, I have an idea what the crime is going to be, but I have no idea how it's going to go, and I have no idea how it's going to end. I think in the writing world, I'm called a pantser. That's right, isn't it? Yeah. And so you have plotters and you have pantsers, apparently. And I'm definitely a pantser. I don't plot anything. I just hope that the characters will lead me through the book, and I get to a successful conclusion, which I guess is where all of you would come in and say, yeah, you did, or no, you didn't. But that, yeah, so that's kind of what I do for crime. I have written another book set on the southwest coast of Scotland that isn't crime. And that is a book I've just got an agent for. And that book is called Driftwood. And that was a bit different because it was the start of lockdown. And I was looking out the window at some whelk pickers, and the headlight was bobbing along the beach. And my wife says to me, "I wonder what else they find on the beach." And that inspired Driftwood. So with crime, I don't know, but with that book, I did.
What about you, Anne? What inspires?
Well, I'm pretty much the same as Ian. I'll have some random idea. I have a really weird mind. If my husband's out of the room for more than 5 minutes, I think, has he fallen over and broken his neck, rather than, oh, he's just taking ages in the toilet because he's on his phone. So it's just... Yeah, if someone turns up late, rather than think, oh, they're just in traffic, I think, what if they've been dragged off and horribly mutilated? It's just the way my brain works, I'm afraid. Sometimes it's wishful thinking, but there you are. But yeah, I usually know what the crime's going to be, and again, I never know why, I never know who did it, and again, I'm a total pantser, which is basically you fly by the seat of your pants. Which we explained to some school children that we do a creative writing course for, and they just thought it was you have to wear your pants over your trousers while you're writing, which we thought, oh, it might work, you know, but it might spur the ideas on. But yeah, again, I'll just think perhaps with the first book, it was a case of, right, I've got a policeman and he's got a disabled child, so therefore he's going to be distracted and he shouldn't actually be at work, but he's had to go in because his colleague's off, so... He's under a lot of stress because he's moving as well, and it's Christmas, so he's got a lot on his plate. So it's the whole idea that he's not got his mind fully on the job, and mistakes get made.
I mean, from my point of view, stories come from all sorts of places, but sometimes the most unexpected. And a number of years ago, my father was, who's passed away now, was gravely ill, and he was in a coma for three months and in hospital. And when it became obvious that he was going to live, even though he was going to sleep for a lot of the time, after 3 or 4 weeks, I became aware of where I was sitting. And I became aware that I was in a side ward. It sounds odd, but you know in these situations, you don't take any notice of anything, really. You just focus on your loved one. And gradually, I started to look around me, and I realized that all the people in all the beds, they were all fellas, all oldish chaps, were all away with the fairies. They'd either got, as my dad had, dementia, or they'd got a urinary infection. Anyone who's ever had one or knows someone who's got one knows that temporarily they go completely bonkers. And it was full of people living in their own world. And there was a guy directing trains. There was another one talking to a wife who wasn't there. And they were all in their own world. My dad was in Russia in the few moments when he came to his senses. And gradually, I thought, what if... What if there's a guy in a hospital bed and he's talking and talking and talking and it's rubbish? Absolute rubbish. Because he's got a urinary infection and everyone knows that. But what if the guy in the next room, the next bed, is an old copper, retired copper, and he knows that the guy in the bed next to him who's doing all the talking is the secrets man, a member of a gang that had been dominant 20 or 30 years ago, the keeper of the secrets, and what he was hearing was all the secrets coming out. And what if my retired copper's best mate is my central character, DCI John Blizzard? And what if he told Blizzard, what would Blizzard do? How long would it take word to get out? And how long would it take someone to come for the old man and shut him up? And I was so gripped by this, I went to my family and I said, look, this is probably bad taste. I want to write this novel. Do you mind? And they said, no, no, just go for it. And I just thought that's an example of how unlikely a story you could get. Jackie?
Yeah. I think I'm a wee bit different in how mine originate. They tend to come with a character, and that comes into my head as a like almost like a feeling, a shadow, with Farrell, which it was in, you know, I just almost like this Jesuit feel with the cassock whispering along the ground. And this very, my original inspiration for Farrell was that he had was very austere. You know, he's quite an aesthetic man and all the rest of it. But he ended up being different because he couldn't, I couldn't not have him have a sense of humour. It just kept slipping in. So then I wrote a monologue just to find his true voice, and it did have that humour in it. So I had to kind of change the original perception. But first of all, I get that shadowy sense of character. And then eventually I hear their voice and they start talking or saying little snatches of things like that. Then I think, well, what kind of, what do I want the book to be about? What kind of world is it going to involve? And then the plot really will take off from there. But it always starts with a person. For my new series I'm writing that I've got coming out later this year, I started writing that in lockdown, and the image, therefore, probably sounds a bit depressing, but the image that came to mind was, now that I'm up at East Lothian, it was this woman swimming at Portobello Beach, and she was swimming out to sea, and she did this regularly, and every time she couldn't decide whether to keep swimming or whether to turn back. So she became the inspiration for my PI, who had lost a son, and of course she was in a very dark place, which to me felt appropriate with COVID happening, because I suppose all of us were in a bit of a dark place. So that was how she came. And then again I thought, well, how can, she's obviously suffering from grief, how can I reflect that in a plot? So for me the plot is secondary, character always comes first.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, before we go up to questions from the audience, because I'm sure you'll have plenty, and move into the interval, Ian, do you want to read some stuff from your work?
Yeah, I certainly will. So this is, I'll read you the prologue from Cover Blown, which is my latest series featuring Pippa Nash, a DI, and a DS Nick Moretti. Melissa Phelps' day had been one that she wished to forget. As CEO of an advertising firm in London, stress and work-related grief came with the territory. Some days were worse than others, and today happened to be one of them. Melissa had one final plan in mind: soak the evening away in her deep cast-iron bath. As she exited the lift of her third-floor Thameside domain, she fumbled in her bag. Her phone was there. The corridor was peaceful. As she walked, she heard the faint sound of music coming from one flat and the sound of laughter from another. These noises meant she was home, home to the safe environment she'd loved and nurtured since she'd purchased the flat. As she approached her door, the sensor on her lock recognised her phone, and she pushed it open and entered her home. It was a security system that had attracted her to the block. The modern technology meant that any friends or family she'd arranged to have visit could enter by the click of a button. Wherever she was in the world, with the press of her phone screen, she could let them in. She entered her flat, dispensed with her shoes, and dropped her handbag to the floor. She pursed her lips and made a kissing sound. She expected her ragdoll cat, James, to come for a cuddle. There was no approach or mewing for food. She suspected he was putting the covered litter tray to use. She hung her coat and shuffled a deck of mail the concierge had handed her at the communal reception. She caught a glimpse of herself in the hall mirror and doubled back and paused before she entered her bathroom. Her attention was caught by what she thought was movement coming from her bedroom. A shadow had masked the light coming from the window that leaked through the crack between frame and door. She ignored it, suspecting it was the cat. She headed to the bathroom, undressed, and sat on the edge of the bath. She turned the ornate dials on the hot and cold water taps. Once she was satisfied all was in order, she strode through the kitchen, confident in her naked body. Privacy glass in the windows provided sanctuary from prying eyes. She poured herself a tall glass of red wine as she listened to the drum of the bathwater as it cascaded from the waterfall taps into the cast-iron bath. Again, she heard movement, a creaking of wood, as though a door was being opened. She walked through to her bedroom and scanned the empty room. Nothing untoward, just her double bed, a chest of drawers, and a built-in wardrobe that spanned the wall and was a good depth to hold her many coats. She returned to the kitchen, grabbed a glass of wine and went back to the bathroom, where she checked the water's temperature and ran the pinkish fluid through her manicured hands. The tint in the water, courtesy of a lavender bath bomb, she'd added as a last-minute luxury. She slipped into the water and relaxed her neck and head on the roll-top edge. The smell of lavender was replaced by leather as a gloved hand grasped her mouth and forced her head underwater. She thrashed against the pressure being exerted from above, and as she opened her eyes, a dark blur towered over her, the shape disrupted by the glint of teeth, teeth that appeared as though they'd been wired into a callous grimace. Her assailant's eyes hazed in the water. The hands that held her throat pushed harder as they pressed her head against the floor of the bath. Melissa tried to scream, but the pressure on her throat rendered her any effort worthless. She felt her world slow. The echo of her water-filled scream subsided to nothing.
Two things about life strike me as odd. One of which is that there are crime writers prepared to do horrible things to good people. And the other one is that there's loads of people like yourself prepared to enjoy it. And I always ask readers, what is it about crime fiction that appeals to you? And they always come back and say, it's because it's happening to someone else. It is horrible. There is a mad axeman, but he's not looking for me. So we'll lead up to the interval with a few questions from the audience, because we've done quite a bit of the talking, so your chance. Anybody got any questions? We'll do in the second half what we did in the first half. We'll chat for about half an hour and then turn it over for some questions. We'll have a couple of readings as well. My experience of these three people that I'm sitting up here with is they're thoroughly decent human beings. They are kind. Two of them are kind and generous. They're generous people and good people. So my first question to start with the second half is, where on earth do your murderers come from? Where do the horrible people come from, given that you're so pleasant?
That was very kind of you. I guess partly work experience. It would have to be that. Definitely. You know, having said that, though, I'd say that the majority of suspects that I work with, because I was on a major investigation team that primarily concentrated on the murder of children. So that was quite traumatic, an area to deal with. And I don't write about that in any of my books, and I won't write about that in any of my books, because... I don't believe that is a subject area for entertainment at all in terms of crime fiction. But going back to the question, I think they just, yeah, it has to be policing. It has to be policing. And but then I can kind of twist the protagonist, the suspects, their mental states and stuff like that a lot more. Yeah, if that answers that question.
Oh, for me, it's just a good way of getting back on your enemies. Yeah. We've all had the annoying cold caller on the phone that insists your broadband is wrong. And if you give him all your money and buy him a load of Amazon vouchers, he can fix it. Yeah, just people in life who have upset me, really. I just like to bump them off.
It's interesting that Ian refers to child abuse, because you're absolutely right. It's not a pleasant subject. For many people, it's a taboo subject. And yet I've written about it twice. And the reason I wrote about it twice is when I was a crime reporter working in a city in England, I came across a true case of an unsolved child murder. It's been unsolved now for 20 or 30 years. And when I was a journalist down there, we had a £100,000 reward, which was a lot of money then and a lot of money now. And we didn't get a single call. And the murder remains unsolved. And there were rumours circulating about powerful people protecting powerful people. And I was drawn to write about this as a subject. And I learned a really valuable lesson. And it kind of backs up what Ian said, really. I wrote a scene. I don't go in for graphic scenes. I don't do graphic sex. I don't do graphic pornography. I don't do graphic violence. And I wrote a scene that was quite subtle, but hinted at a child that had been abused. And I read it to Frances, my wife, who some of you met earlier. And I said, isn't that good? Because I was looking at it as a technical writer. I thought, that's brilliant, that works. And she says, that's revolting. It's horrible, it makes me think horrible things. And I realised then that we kind of forget that what we write sometimes has an impact on people. What about you?
I don't take my crimes, I suppose, from real life. I think for me, reading has always been an escape. You know, if I want, this is just my personal taste. If I want to read, you know, gritty social reality or whatever, then I'll look at the news. You know, I tend to want to escape in my own personal reading taste. So I think my crimes more come from, you know, the setting, the fictional world I've put, and the dynamics of the world that I've put the story around, you know. And I suppose I don't realise at the time, but I suppose often I have a kind of redemption idea going on, you know. So it's more to fit my themes and to fit the world I've put it in, rather than, you know, starting from a de facto person point of view. Apart from, there's one person that I did put in for revenge, but I'm not going to say who it is.
So the next questioner is, how do you approach the subject of evil? Given that people are not all evil, they have redeeming features, and even your murderers will have redeeming features, how do you approach that as writers? Do you want a little bit of your reader to like the characters who are committing crimes?
Yes. So just to clarify, all my book, although I might draw from some policing experience, all of my books are fiction. So they're not based on any true investigation or anything like that, or any really anybody that I've dealt with. For the benefit of the tape. We've got to be careful nowadays. We've got to be careful. And I do love a flawed protagonist, though. And the Rubicon series that I wrote, I wrote that under Ian Patrick. And I think part of that was because I didn't think it would go anywhere or do anything, to be honest with you. So I thought, well, I could just kind of hide away behind a pseudonym and everything will be okay. But then the BBC optioned Rubicon for a 6-part TV series, and I was like, oh, that's fantastic. But sadly, the pandemic killed that. But it got that got as far as two BAFTA-nominated scriptwriters who wrote Prey, Michael Walker and Chris Lunt, and they outlined it all, and so there was hope there. But that is, going back to your question, John, that is a flawed protagonist who is a detective sergeant, and that was fun to write, because my last 8 years of policing were in covert work, and we were trained in kind of anti-corruption. So the great thing about writing that character is the Sam Batford was that he would do everything I wouldn't do, and so that made it very challenging for me to write that character, because there were things that he ended up doing that even I, as the writer, was going, oh God, he's actually going to do that. And so that helped me write that character. If he was to write it based on how I would have done it, it would be a very, very dull book. So yeah. So that's how. So I do. That's how I did it.
Oh, it's difficult to say, really. I mean, like I said in the first half, I'm just sick of reading about policemen with a drink problem, or policemen who cheat on their wives, or so. I wanted my policeman to have a happy home life, although he's got this issue because he's got a disabled son who, as many people who've got disabled children will know, they're not always as sweet and light as you see. So I'd wanted to write what I knew, and I'm going to go and rewrite book two completely now. because it's about child abuse. But again, I wrote what I know because I grew up in a house with a paedophile and I'm not allowed to kill him in real life. But I'm actually killing paedophiles in the book. And there's no description of anything apart from one woman reads out her story in a group. But that's her words, and they're partly my words. The rest of it is complete fiction. But obviously, I've got compassion for my killers, and I want them to be liked. And there's obviously they're doing bad things for good reasons, which I think is probably the redeeming quality.
Yeah, and certainly for me, I'm fascinated. I write a lot about organised crime, but I'm more interested in what makes ordinary people, as it were, if there's such a thing, turn to crime, and what are the motives that you know, what will they do to protect the loved ones or the money or the secret or whatever? I mean, one of my contacts, I haven't seen him for a while, is a mass murderer, and he's got he did at one point have 26 murders to his credit, but he lost a few on appeal, and he's portrayed in the media as a deeply unpleasant, horrible human being. And it sounds odd, but you really can spend a very pleasant afternoon with him. But he's evil as anything. So that's what fascinates me.
Yes, I think in terms of the whole aspect of evil, that was very much, you know, good versus evil was very much one of the themes in the first book in the D.I. Farrell series, because I was viewing it through the lens of him as a Roman Catholic priest. And, you know, I think, therefore, that I found that quite an interesting thing to play with. I'm always very interested in psychology, always have been. And I'm very interested in mental illness and how that contributes to the, you know, good versus evil debate, if you like. You know, are you bad? Are you mad? And of course, there's this whole new wave of biological determinism as well. And so, I would suggest that even a psychopath, which I've got more of a psychopath in the second book. But I suppose no matter how cold and lacking in empathy, etc., someone is, if that is biological determinism, if they have no choice but to live their life in that way in terms of being unable to have a conscience as opposed to, choosing to ignore that conscience till it becomes mute. You know, how does that fit into good versus evil? So all of these things I'm quite interested in. My books have quite a strong psychological element. I'm very interested in how people tick. So yeah, that's in terms of the whole evil aspect. I quite like playing with that in different ways. But like John said, someone that appears to have done the most reprehensible things, you know, is, you know, can have redeeming qualities, I suppose.
I think, yeah, as well, like it kind of maybe the predominant amount of those people are coming from places of unresolved trauma, and it's very easy to just label them as evil, and it's not to gloss over whatever acts there are, but in all the suspects I dealt with, there would at the end of if we, you know, when we got to court, there would be psychiatric reports presented, and you can't ignore the trauma and the unresolved trauma that they've experienced, not to excuse the act that they've done. I think that's the difference. And certainly none of them would have woken up in the morning, stretched their arms, and, oh, I think I'm going to go out and kill today. It's something in them snapped. And, I've certainly learned over the last couple of years, none of us asked to be born with the tricky brains that we have. And, you know, we have no input in how our brains are. We're born and we have to get on with the brains that we have. And some of us do better than others, I think.
Time for a reading, I think. Anne?
Her mouth was open, but the scream refused to come out as she was dragged backwards on her stomach across the dimly lit path. A pair of strong hands wrapped around her bare ankles. Sorry, I should have taken a breath before I did that. She scrabbled frantically at the hard-packed earth, the broken glass, the barbed wire fence, trying desperately to get a purchase on anything she could to thwart her attacker. Her dress rucked up beneath her, and she tried in vain to tug it back down, to cover what little of her modesty remained. Fingers wound their way into her hair and tightened into a fist, yanking her head back painfully as a scarf was looped around her parched throat and a heavy weight settled on her back. Her tongue lolled out as she choked and tried in vain to suck air in through her crushed airway. The scarf was pulled tighter and her eyes flickered as she began to lose consciousness, the world descending into darkness. The last thing she heard before her body gave up the fight was a voice coming from what seemed like miles away, calling out, "What the fuck are you doing?" And then we skip forward to where DI Alex Peachy is called in from leave. He's called in from leave. He's supposed to be moving house. He's supposed to have Christmas off, and his friend goes down with gallstones. So Alex's mobile phone trilled, startling him and waking Jane. He grabbed it, checked the display, and went into the bathroom to take the call. A few moments later, Jane heard the shower running. She sighed and turned on the lamp. The bedside clock read 12 a.m. So much for being on leave, she grumbled to herself. Alex emerged from the bathroom, a towel around his waist, his hair standing on end. "I'm sorry, darling, but someone's found a body behind the Leymore Club in Wolverhampton. Charlie Baldwin's been rushed to surgery with gallstones, so it looks like I'm in charge." He dressed quickly and attempted to flatten his hair down. "It's fine, I've got Washington Poe to keep me company." She waved a copy of the new M.W. Craven book at him. "I'll leave you in his capable hands then," Alex smiled as he slipped his jacket on. A car horn sounded from outside, so he kissed Jane and hurried downstairs, leaving her with a novel.
Excellent, thank you very much. Next question is the one that divides crime readers more than any. Gorefest or more subtle? From my point of view, I don't particularly want to write bloodbath stuff. I don't want to write graphic details of injuries and graphic details of crimes. For me, it's enough sometimes to really tell the crimes, the violent scenes fairly sort of briefly. But clearly for some writers, and very successful writers, it's all about the gore fest and it's all about graphic stomach-churning stuff. Where do you stand on it?
Oh, I'm the same as you, John. The violence always happens off the page to a large degree, in that bodies are found rather than a blow-by-blow account of, you know, taking you through the murder, etc. I think that's because personally I'm really squeamish and I would struggle because I'd write it vividly and I'd be going, ooh, ooh, you know, so it wouldn't do. I wouldn't like to spend my time doing that personally. But, yeah, so... definitely off the page for me.
If it adds to the story, then fair enough, I think. But if it doesn't, and it's just gratuitous, there's no point. Plus, I think with my police head on, the simpler for me, the better, because all I'd be thinking of is if it's a kind of gore fest, is that the soccer will be turning up. And in my head, it'd be just like, oh, that's too much to manage. And, you know, forensically, they're never going to pay to have all that examined. So I'll just keep it simple. And then that just helps my brain. Then I can just keep moving forward then.
Yeah, I do the same. I leave it off the page. I'll hint at what's to come. And then I'll show you the aftermath, but I won't put what's going on. Particularly with obviously, the child abuse stuff. I mean, I've got... some of the chapters are written in italics because they're from the killer's point of view. So I've got the killer showing the victim a pair of pruning shears and saying, what do you think of these? And obviously he knows what's coming and you know what's coming, but I don't, you know, you just see what happens when the police find him.
A couple of questions before we hand it back over to the audience. Crime fiction deals with tough subjects. How do you approach that? And you've already answered this to a degree. Are there subjects you won't tackle, Ian?
Yes, there's one I've said I won't tackle at all, and but I'd kind of throw it back to all of you, really. Like, you read crime fiction, and my understanding is that there'll be an expectation of maybe a crime that you'd expect to see in one of those books. But maybe I'm completely wrong. Because in the Batford series, that doesn't really deal with murder. That kind of deals with a corrupt undercover officer who's trying to dig his way out of a hole that he keeps on falling into. Those I did enjoy, really did enjoy writing. The Nash and Moretti series, I equally enjoy writing, but they're tougher for me to write because it involves murder and trying to solve that with a detective and a DS. So, that's kind of my take on that. So I think it would have to be, that's why the murder side I write, because my understanding is that that is what a reader wishes to read about, because and expect a resolution at the end of it. Because if it's open-ended, then it would be quite disappointing. But I stand to be corrected, or sit to be corrected, should I say.
I won't ever kill an animal, ever, no matter what it is. Because people hate you if you do that. They do. Obviously, J.D. Kirk did it in his first book. He shows the torture of a cat, and he got marked down quite severely for that. He's never done it since. But he did, you know, it was necessary to the plot, but it was, for some people, it was still too much. Obviously, I touched on the child abuse thing, but it's only because I know about it. So, I wouldn't write about that again. Apart from, like I said, just really that sort of thing, animals, I wouldn't hurt animals.
Yeah, I think certainly from my point of view, nothing's off limits, really, if the story demands it. And I will write about animal cruelty because one of my characters is an animal lover and doesn't like people, does like animals. And one of the scenes of which I'm proudest, I think, was as a journalist, I investigated dogfighting, an absolutely vicious crime. Harris investigated dogfighting, came across a dog that was dying, and it was the only time he cried. And for me, that was important because it told you something about the character.
Yes, I think perhaps due to, you know, having come across some things like you were alluding to in my work, I very much don't. There's certain subjects such as child abuse, etc., animal cruelty, you know, things I won't, anything too real, I suppose, I don't really like touching on because of the whole reading for escapism idea. But I did actually get pulled up once, and it just really took me aback how the power of words, if you like, because despite all my scruples and, you know, everything happening off the page, etc., I had one scene, I think it's actually in book two, the Kirkcudbright book, actually, where I got into an awful lot of trouble with, you know, trigger alerts all over and, you know, real horrible review because I had this fictional murderer had fictionally painted a picture of a fictional animal merely restrained, but with the suggestion, again, nothing graphic, the suggestion of, you know, cruelty, although it's a static image. And someone was so terribly upset by this having this in there that they made it sound like my book was a complete, you know, butcher fest from beginning to end. And I don't blame the person because obviously just in the broad strokes I'd made it too vivid for them. But, you know, it really did quite take me aback because that's not the kind of stuff I write. But this person had been really quite affected by it. So that certainly gave me pause for thought, you know, moving forward.
Those of us whose books are sold on Amazon will know all about Amazon reviews. My worst ever one was if this book was free, I wouldn't buy it. You can kind of forgive them. The final question before I do a brief reading and then we turn it over to yourselves to take us up to the end. Do you as writers feel a responsibility to your readers to ensure that the good guy always wins? And from my point of view, yes, because at the end of the day, I want some kind of sense of justice having been done. The bad guys lose, the guys in the white hats win, and that's the way I view it.
Yes, I think it's a bit of a cathartic experience almost, you know, getting that payoff at the end of the book. So yes, I would agree with, like, it has to be, the worst thing I think you can do is leave a reader hanging, because I hate that myself. I mean, I know there's different schools of thoughts on this, but personally, I like, you know, my books tied up with a bow. You know, everything's, you know, resolved, and if they can't resolve it, I want an epilogue, preferably in a good book for the next 30 years, but, you know, I just like it all tied up neatly.
Excellent, that's everyone, isn't it?
I mean, for me, it's the bad guy, the good guy doesn't always win in real life. So as long as justice is served, there may be some fallout to the good guy, but ultimately justice is served.
Yeah, excellent. Ian?
Yeah, mine tend to be the same. There is a resolution at the end of it. And I think that's because I'm asking you to invest your time in my work, so I want to ensure that you kind of get to the end. You think, oh, that was a great book, rather than just think, well, I don't know what happened in the end, and you know, it's unresolved. And that's where I'm coming.
Excellent.
From.
Well, I'll do a brief reading, and then we'll turn it over to yourselves for the last few minutes. I wanted to do something slightly different with Last Man Alive. And this is a story that begins when it's set in the North Pennines that the Jack Harris novels are, and police get called to a burgled farmhouse up in the hills, and since they're up there, they decide to check other houses in the area, check if there's been any other break-ins, and they come across a cottage, a very remote cottage, that's deserted. The doors are unlocked, it's clearly been left, and all they find sitting on the coffee table is this note. Since you were reading this, I must assume that I was not the last man alive after all. I must also assume that you have found my body. That in itself is remarkable. I've always rather taken it for granted that no one would ever find me after I died. No one ever comes here, and recently I've begun to believe that there was no one left alive anyway. That the human race had finally done what it always threatened to do, and destroyed itself, whether by war or pestilence. I'm also rather assuming that this letter is being read. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's mouldering away, words speaking to nobody. I'm not sure when things changed. I say things changed, but I'm not really sure that they did. Perhaps nothing happened. Maybe my mind has played isolation's final trick. Maybe all of this is imagined. To be honest, I've struggled to differentiate reality from the imagined in recent months. Dementia, if that's what's afflicting me, and I haven't consulted a doctor, can do that to you, and isolation doesn't help. Things have certainly been getting worse over recent months. If you are reading this, you can see that my home stands 8 miles from the main road and is reached only by a rough track, inaccessible to all but the most robust of vehicles. When I moved here all those years ago, the removals van snapped an axle on the track, and the men insisted that only the barest essentials could be transported to the house, which explains why it's so sparsely furnished. I didn't object. I came here to escape my old life. I was an advertising executive, one of those flash men who wore braces to the office and lived in an apartment in the middle of London, all ornaments and original paintings, the trappings of a well-paid lifestyle, and outside the sounds of a busy city. Today, here in my cottage, there is no noise, no television, no radio, no internet, just the voices in my head. They're noisy enough, but I cannot seem to silence them. God knows I've tried. My isolation explains why it took so long to realize that something had happened. Even though one ever visits me, I never receive post. I did have the occasional reminder that life goes on, usually in the form of hikers. Several weeks ago, or maybe months, I have little sense of time these days. There was a wildlife photographer. I assume he was a wildlife photographer. He had a camera and seemed interested in the ravens that nest on the escarpment, which is where he pitched his tent. Next morning, he'd gone, leaving Hag's Scare to the birds once more.
Also reminding me about the outside world was the occasional drumming of engines over on the valley road. It was the cars that first made me realise that something had changed. I was cutting wood for the fire one day when I realised I hadn't heard an engine for a long time. What if I was the last man alive? If it was true, it would mean I'd finally attained everything I'd always wanted. However, I must find out to be sure.